Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. John McMurtry is on today. John and I got, shall I say, were rained out last month in September. We plan to discuss the new edition of John's important book, The Cancer Stage of Capitalism. Well, it didn't get entirely washed out. We rescheduled it. We're going to discuss it today. Before I get on with that with John, let me just make a few comments. I think unless somebody's been asleep for a number of weeks, they know there are shenanigans going on in America. You know, the shutdown, the budget debate, the debt ceiling limit coming probably around October 17. But it's not really October 17. And there's really billions of dollars left, and there's all kinds of finagling that could be done. So it could be another week or two or a month or longer, even if the shutdown continues, that America will be able to pay the debts it wants to pay, which means maybe Social Security checks won't go out, but you can bet investors holding government debt will have it serviced. They'll be taken care of. America's wars won't stop. The military may not be paid, but the fighting will go on. The bombs will keep dropping. The factories will keep pumping out weapons and munitions. All of that goes down. Maybe Lady Liberty is closed. Well, I understand it's opening back up again. Some national parks are opening back up again. The dirty scheme behind this shutdown, so-called debate, is both parties are really in lockstep. They may disagree around the edges, but what's going on is an attack on social America. It's hardening repression in America. It's literally turning America more into a police state than it already is. And this is what's already been agreed on. It was agreed on long ago. This isn't new policy. It's long-standing policy. Social protections have been destroyed year after year after year. The standard of living for ordinary Americans is at best no better. Well, let me put it this way. Adjusted for inflation, it's worse than it was 30 years ago. Worse. The current generation is the first in American history, probably the worst, that's worse off than the previous one. Usually generations, new ones, do better than the previous ones. The current one, maybe the two current ones, because we're going back to the 1970s, worse off than their predecessors. Never happened before. It certainly is happening now, and it's getting worse and worse. Democrats and Republicans and Obama, they want to hand over America to profiteers. That's what this dirty deal is about. They want to turn over Medicare, Social Security, and Medicare to profiteers so that they can profit at the expense of ordinary people. There'll be a deal cut. Will it be today, tomorrow, a week from now, next week, next month? It doesn't matter. America will go on. Most of the government is still functioning. Ordinary people are the ones that will be harmed. And I think, John, in your cancer stage of capitalism, you may not touch on the debt crisis debate, but you should touch on the larger issue.
It all connects, Steve. It all connects. And I'm going to try to explain today how it does. I mean, just specifically to what you've just said, with which, by the way, I agree to the letter. Everything you've said is true and demonstrably true. It is not a speculation. It's a fact. This whole debt thing that is just, you know, with the division between the two parties, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, what I've worried about, in fact, there's some alarm. I've been having a little bit of correspondence with Ellen Brown and others on this, is that this specific one I think that Wall Street's planning for another great metastasis. Once you destabilize, like that's what they did in 2008, once you destabilize, and it's just, of course, transnational money sequences multiplying themselves, that's the cancer, and they're just biting at the bit, and they've got the trillions of dollars of derivatives out there and so forth, and now they've got the new bail-in provision, and that's quite you'll of course know about it, which means now they can not only take, the government's going to be reluctant to give them trillions of dollars again, and so now they're allowing them to bail into people's actual private accounts. And if we have a crisis as we're having here, it's perfect for that to happen so that what wasn't accomplished by the 2008 metastasis of Wall Street will now be accomplished by allowing by law that they can now, in order to pay other banks, because the derivatives and so forth, other banks' claims have the first bid on any debt, they're going to be able to dip into everybody's accounts so they can take everything. And so what you were emphasizing, which is absolutely correct, and I think furthermore it may be the most important thing, was that one way or another, I mean, dipping into people's personal accounts is about the best way. You know, they're already, I mean, you know, those who have any, they're stripped too. That's all being set up. And they have, as you know too, they have the military system and the, you know, the police state legislation to put all that into tack as soon as people start to protest. But the social aspect of it is just one, I mean, that's just one dimension of this cancer stage of capitalism. I mean, the air, the soil, the water, everything, they're all cumulatively degrading. I mean, that gets underneath, well, that is, you'd say, the life support system, the collective life support systems of society. They're just completely ignored, and they're degrading into emergency, and I won't go into all the figures, but half the world is going to be short of water shortly, and already is to a very large extent, and it's being polluted, and it's being drawn down. But meanwhile, what people, you know, what the official press is focusing on most is climate warming, but in fact it isn't warming at all. It's extremes. I mean, warming is just a euphemism. You know, it's a climate destabilization and a hydrological cycle destabilization, which is why we get all the floods and so forth. But not only that's happening, all the people, all the beings, all the life, our fellow creatures are in species extinction spasm. So it just, you know, so far I haven't even mentioned the social one, which you properly emphasize, but it's only one part of this massive, invasive, money sequence cancer system for which the only diagnosis, as I will, you know, explain in a moment, can be that. But it isn't just the species all in spasm extinction. Of course, the pollution cycles and the volume is just the pollution itself, which people take increasing attention to, but absolutely really nothing effective is done about it. So, you know, you have life in danger at every... There is no life system in existence now that is not in degradation or threat or in decline. None. Try to name one. So it just goes way, way beyond what we're dealing with just stripping the social infrastructure. Of course, that's where the new demand comes. If you can get into the pockets of the state itself through future taxation, then, and that's what it is. It's just a slow process of converting all that did serve life, that served life and life capital. All of that is taken out and turned into Wall Street and similar related money sequences. But it's not just that. The food system, the very food system that we live on, we produce an enormous amount of food, but almost none of it makes it through as nutrition. 40 to 50% of it is wasted. I mean, it depends which country you're talking about. Is wasted. It's just thrown away or otherwise wasted. But what food remains and is sold, it has nothing but calories in it. It's just empty calories, John, over 50%. And so our food system is in crisis. So wherever you go, you know, and that's all creating diseases, new diseases that never existed before, of which cancer is the most notable. But not only that, obesity, and then that leads to diabetes and heart attack through junk foods, and on we go. Every one of them, it's commodity diseases from this system.
John, let me just mention one thing. Listeners may know that yesterday was the second global anti-Monsanto march, and
yes,
I wrote an article that I rushed to get out yesterday, and I called it anti-Monsanto activism. You talk about foods that aren't nutritious, John. I mean, GMO foods cause disease and death. That's what they are, and they're literally licensed to be produced. And the poison is literally inflicted on people who eat this stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, people GMO is one spike of the whole system. But even if you stroked out GMOs tomorrow, which of course they're not going to do, they're deliberately contaminating the world with GMOs because they're the dominant gene. These genes are injected into animals, and they're injected into seeds and so forth with absolutely no idea of where they're going to take or how they're going to take or how it's going to turn out ecologically. And being the dominant gene, they contaminate everything they touch. They are now 4,000 miles away from source. They're contaminating the world. That's a definite policy. But even if you took the GMOs out, and by the way, the big money that's behind it in the foundations, like the Bill Gates Foundation, Melinda Gates Foundation, they're very much into GMOs because their foundations make a lot of money out of this. And what the poisoning, you're quite right, it can, you know, experiments have shown that it can rot the guts of rats. And then as soon as that's done, the guy is a very eminent guy who actually I was in communication with when it happened. He was a very eminent scientist who had been pro-GMO. He was stripped of his laboratory. He was stripped of his position. He was completely disgraced, and all he did was report what actually happened with his GMOs and the rats. But the biggest danger isn't even there. The biggest danger from GMO is what it does to the ecological system by injecting genes sideways where you have no way what their consequences are. We have no assays of what their long-term consequences are through the environment. In fact, that's all being avoided because they want to deliberately contaminate. Because if you contaminate all the other food genes, and of course this is part of the problem of the bees, because Monsanto's also behind a pest control and other forms of their artificial farming that raises input costs for farmers that cause Indians to commit suicides in the hundreds of thousands. This is hitting the environment most of all in the long term, and of course nothing is done about it. So then but at least we've conquered disease, you think. Well, I think it's true that habits of cleanliness, which are the key to preventing disease, and better water, that will bring down your disease rate, and the infectious disease rate, though very serious, has declined a lot. But now we have with what they call non-communicable diseases, which are, you know, in shorthand, commodity diseases, though they never say it. It's always from commodities and production of commodities, that those diseases are multiplying exponentially. They now surpass all the other diseases in the number of people they infect and cause disease too, disabling diseases too. But we're still not finished. That's really sinister that's going on here, that perhaps the worst thing is the future of the next generation. As you know, there is 50% unemployment in the south of Europe, once the place where, you know, there was 1% unemployment. I mean, that was Europe in the 60s and 70s. There's 50% for those under 25 and rising, over 50%. Well, here, right here in our own, our privileged continent, things are hardly better. People, the next generation, can't find jobs. And if they do have a job, if they train for a job through a higher education, and you've written very well on this, their debt charges, and they're upping the debt charges on them. They're multiplying the debt charges on them. They're ruining them from the start. And you probably can't get a job either. And you know, all the jobs they make a thing about, you know, the unemployment rates going down, as you know, that's because of people dropping out of the search for unemployment. And it's also because of any new jobs that are added don't have benefits, don't have long-time security, don't have pensions, don't have anything that makes life where you have life security. You don't have a livelihood. So that's going on. Meanwhile, then we get to what you started with, which is the stripping of all the social programs. And there's a logic for all of it. And that is, as you pointed out, but we can put it formally, all public investment in life and life support systems is converted into private transnational money sequences with no committed life function to anything. That's the big conversion that's going on. That's the cancer, really, is that you have no committed life function to this multiplying system of demand, of money demand. They say it's population explosion. Well, it's not the population explosion. It's the exponential multiplication of money demand. People as such don't make, aren't the problem. The problem is the demand on the resources of nature and the pollution of them for money sequences. And so we go on and on where... The media, you know, you often talk about the media. And so the thing is, you start to try to, and we, you know, I'm not going to go through the media about how it's been deformed and degraded, but basically anything that, that nothing can be said in the media or in public, official public speech, so that basically any mass communication, nothing can be said that conflicts with or exposes this this great disease system. Anything that anything that I've said so far in this program will never be said. You will never find it on the mass media. You will never find any government admitting it, any part, or even any party contending for power. So you have what you have a collapse of the social defense system. It's not just the infrastructure that supports people's lives, but the defense system of science and understanding of what's going on itself has been stripped. So we have a disease at the great sickness at the second level, you know, at social level of life organization, and we've eliminated all the means of recognizing it. So that here, you know, I mean, Bush was very, you know, very clear on his repression of any science whatsoever that told you the truth of what was going on in the environment and with commodities. Well, that isn't just Bush. That goes right. That's just the policy. And here in Canada, he's our prime minister, who's just basically a Texas oil appointee. He, you know, I mean, they run that too is unspeakable. He's eliminated everything that can tell you anything that's gone wrong. He's eliminated everything from the senses to the great, you know, the lakes experimental basin that found out about how water got polluted, found out about acid rain, found out about all sorts of things. Just eliminated. Anybody who's taking coordinates of the climate destabilization, eliminate the funding for it. That's their big key, is to eliminate funding for anything that isn't promoting or contributing to the transnational money sequencing dominated, of course, by Wall Street as the big, it's the inner wheel of the whole system, as you know. And then meanwhile, as you mentioned, well, how are you going to do this? How are you going to run this through people? Well, you can only run it through people if you have force it on them. And of course, that's why we have more and more police weapons and methods of crowd control and crowd suppression and indeed injuring. Egypt is a good example. It's announcing our feature, by the way. Just go in and shoot them. And then, of course, on the transnational scale, where you really want to repress because people aren't getting anything out of it, on the other end, you accept starvation, wages, and destruction of their environment. It's the destruction of their environment that's almost the worst thing of all. You just run them over. And then what you do is then you select for Islamic fanatics as the people you fund and arm to make it all look like you're fighting Islam, when in fact what you're fighting is a resistance. All the places in Arab, you know, the Arab Spring and so forth, all those places were places that were hit by food spikes. And a neoliberal IMF dictated stripping of social sectors and stripping of crops for export. And so all of these uprisings are explained by the system. Well, what do you do about it? Well, you just manage it in such a way that nobody understands what the real problem is. So eventually you get to ask yourself, when you've got a system that puts the economy against the environment, instead of the environment being the basis of the economy, it is our economic base. They're always putting one off against the other, so it eventually comes down to a mind structure that is demented, that is really quite, you know, clinically insane. I mean, what productivity means, productivity of what? No. What are you producing? Well, there's no criterion of what productivity is of. It could be of weapons. It could be of junk food. It could be of poisons. It could be of, and it increasingly is. of all the new products basically are just producing producing illness. L being on the behalf of the population, not well-being. But even the left doesn't look at this concept of productivity and say, what are we getting productivity of? But then we talk about new efficiencies. All new efficiencies means is they're reducing costs to the money sequences. That's the only thing efficiency means. So if the efficiency destroys the environment, destroys people's food, and strips the government so it's unable to respond to the illness and the degeneration that's going on, you call that a new efficiency. Nobody questions the new efficiency. So they've got to say, well, there's got to be something more than efficiency. There's got to be something more than economy and economics. Well, it isn't efficient and it isn't economics to begin with. It's nothing but reduction of costs to the private money sequences with no committed life function. And so then you have development. What does development mean? Development, as we see everywhere, it's got nothing to do with making people's lives better. It has nothing to do with making, you know, providing more food, better housing, whatever. It's just taking over basically pristine areas that were once very pleasant to live in and exploiting that into more money sequences for developers who are going to do an inferior job and then leave town as soon as they've destroyed everything. Is going on right inside my own city now. What does sustainability mean? I mean, this is, you get a whole mindset that is, as I say, clinically insane. It holds as given and obvious and self-evident and what we must all do as what is in fact the very opposite, in an Orwellian fashion, the very opposite of what it is in fact. Sustainability, all it means to the corporations who are doing sustainability is sustainability of future profits. And so then you get to ask yourself, well, what's going on? I mean, how did this all happen? And of course, we know about the corporations. I won't go into that, but the corporations have all been deregulated and they've all been given absolute power and rights of persons and the so forth. But even on the level that I work, I'm a philosopher, a moral philosopher, a logician. I work at high levels of theory. But even at the high levels of theory, it's all become lifeblind. It's structured to be lifeblind. It's a lifeblind inner logic governing all the great classics of our time. John Rawls's, for example, theory of justice, which you think, oh, that's a kind of a liberal salvation away from this extreme right. And, of course, a lot of people have identified with that. And, of course, there's a struggle and it's all about a debate. But Rawls's theory of justice and the whole industries of literature around it, they have no, life needs have no place in it. There's no environment in it. There's no society in it. It's just self-maximizing atoms deciding what's the best deal for them, where they're all looking for a larger share for themselves. He says it right out. And this itself is not a matter of critical, like I've done critiques of it, and I publish critiques of it, but you will never see that critique published in what you might call mainstream. It's anathema. You're not allowed, even at the level of high theory, to understand what's going on. And of course, the structure of thinking is such that, and here almost the most important operation comes in, it's structured so that the enemy can only be those who oppose this cancer system. That's the enemy. And if you look anywhere where somebody's called an enemy, it will, of course, never say this, never in a million years, because that's the key to the disease, is that it masks itself to the surrounding community of life. It's always what opposes this system's increase in metastasis with no limit. It's always that. So whatever does that, and you know, you'll be an enemy and I'll be an enemy on it, but since we're well within the law and we don't preach violence, and since we're actually well considered by large numbers of people, then it's not so easy to just send a drone in, although we both do sometimes wonder whether if we do get too much communicated that the drone might hit us. That the enemy is always somebody who opposes it. But if you oppose it on the ground, for sure you're an enemy, and for sure you're going to be attacked, and that's the only enemy the system has. what recognizes what's gone wrong with it, or more primitively, what is opposing what it's doing. Although most of the enemies have no idea, for example, the constructed Islamic enemy has really no idea of this this level of diagnosis. So then you begin to ask yourself, well, you know, what multiplies itself without inhibition? What keeps invading other areas? What has no regulation, no rules of its self-multiplication? What overrides all other requirements of life? What metastasizes across all the functions and regions of life, both on the micro level of the body and the social level, and of course the ecological, the planetary ecological level? What does this? What diagnosis can we give to this? How can we understand what's going on? And you know, it's like, what disorder is not committed to any life function? You know, that's the key one. And what so progressively infiltrates and occupies an organization that it can no longer function in one zone after another, and it's just degrading and degrading and degrading? And what does the life host always never able to recognize? Because in the micro level as well as the macro level, as soon as this is recognized, then the life host goes into well-known operations of selecting it out, of taking it out, of re-regulating it, basically, because that's what we can do at the macro level. And so what eventually, if we don't get to see what's going on, what eventually destroys the life host's conditions of existence and the life itself? So then that's where the cancer diagnosis comes out. And so the question that one wants to put to you and to the audience is, what other diagnosis can you give this amazingly rich set of phenomena that themselves have not been connected? What can possibly be the common cause at work here? What framework of understanding? And just as a doctor, I mean, even Jeffrey Sachs says that economics, good economics, is ultimately looking for the underlying disease. What underlying disease or disorder fits all the phenomena I've just spent all this time discussing, and I've hardly, you know, I haven't touched all of them. You look anywhere, just tell me anything I've missed, and then tell me whether it isn't acting in accordance with the same hallmark characteristics of a carcinogenic invasion. And so that's the question I'll just pose to you. I've been talking for a long time here. And just, can you think of anything that falls outside it? Well, or John, any other model that will work,
John,
for understanding.
You cover the ground so well, and you make a very strong point that when you talk about the cancer system, it's not a metaphor. It's a world system disorder. And it literally,
yeah.
I mean, it is literally, it's invaded us. It's killing us. It literally is a life-destroying disease. What else can you call
yeah,
it?
Unlike any other disease. No other disease. I mean, you know, I talk about this with doctors all the time, and one doctor said to me, well, you know, when you get poisoned, you know, you get poisoned, the poison sweeps through your body. And indeed, it reprograms itself in order to avoid, or sometimes diseases too, in order to avoid the antidotes that we give to an antibiotics and so forth, or whatever the antigen is to the poison. And I said, well, yeah, but it's not at the productive level. That's the really sinister thing about cancer, is that it's at the productive level itself. It's the you know, with a poison, the whole body is fighting against it and fighting to exist and so forth. It isn't reproducing the body itself isn't reproducing these poisons, isn't reproducing what, in the case of cancer, is always, it's a large unit of demand in the life host that demands all more and more and more through its multiplication, uninhibited and unregulated multiplication,
John,
with no stop. Yeah, I hear the music.
We have a break coming up.
Yeah.
Hold your thought. We'll take a break, and we'll come right back. Welcome back. Talking with John McMurtry, his important new edition of his book, The Cancer Stage of Capitalism. John, a phrase I like to use.
Just for a little point of information there, Steve, the new subtitle, which is very important because gets us down, is From Crisis to Cure.
Yes.
Because a lot of the book is about the cure that already underlies our lives without our seeing it. And so it's From Crisis to Cure is a good thing to, you know, folks to know.
Indeed, yeah. I do know that, and it reminds me of the subtitle of Ellen Brown's new book on public banking. Subtitle is From Austerity to Prosperity. And I think
that's good.
Oh, Ellen, you know Ellen, and Ellen's
She's the best person really on banking.
She's so long coming.
You know, we've been waiting for that kind of capacity of understanding. And being a lawyer, she's very exact. You know, on the understanding legislation and so forth. So yes, I agree.
Oh, and her book is marvelous, and she's a regular on this program, like you are, John. And before her book came out, she kept having to make revisions because there was updated information she kept having to put in.
It overwhelms. That's why I go to principles that don't, you know, the first edition was way back in 1999. That was before 2001, 9/11, and the 9/11 wars. That was before 2008. That was before the ruin of Europe by the same banking system. You know, when you think, holy man, all those things exactly expressed the disorder that was diagnosed. And the way to get, you know, the problem of updating is I, you know, of course, this has something to do with being a philosopher. You always look for principles that endure through time. So when I'm actually writing and so forth, I always think of, well, supposing I were transported 100 years hence and I was allowed to look back on what happened, what I wrote now, and anything that could happen between now and then, have I taken account of it?
Well, your book would be timeless, John. There's no question about that. And the other books of yours, I've read Value Wars. I mean, these are timeless principles, and they will stand the test of time. A decade, 100 years from now, you can look back. Well, the one principle that Ellen writes about, and I certainly have covered it in my writing, the principle of public banking over privatized banking. Doesn't work.
But it isn't sufficient. It's utterly key. In fact, I would agree with you that it is the primary key in our inside the situation that we're in now and has been for, you know, I was on to public banking way back, but not, I wouldn't call myself as well informed as Ellen, but I understood it in principle. And it's become more and more because, derivatives didn't exist, before the third millennium. They really didn't exist until we had that legislation enabling them. You know, to use depositors' money, etc. It's the key, but it won't be enough. Like, China has a really good public banking system located at the municipal level. It's really quite amazing, and that really accounts for their tremendous strides forward in terms of producing commodities for the market at an enormous rate and cheap costs and throwing 300 million people under the bus in doing so. The public banking is utterly necessary and primarily necessary, so we're all in agreement there, but it is not sufficient. You've got to know what you're investing in. And here's where I find basically the problem is missing and the people who are really alert to how badly wrong things have gone. And that is having an understanding of what the ultimate, what I call life capital, grounding yourself in life capital and its criteria so that we have something to ground in that is measurable. I mean, life capital is life wealth that produces more life wealth without loss and cumulative gain. There's no other concept but capital that can get those principles in there. You know, wealth, in this case, life wealth that produces more life wealth without loss and cumulative gain. That's what the money sequence capital gone into its cancerous form has always been a false substitute for. And it's always been the underlying intuition is that you must protect your capital. You must not run it down. You must not waste it. All those principles apply more primarily and only in life coherently to life capital itself. And so I have even an algorithm, which I'll share with you on this, because I may be doing another work just focusing on this one concept, so that it's the evolving value base. It is the value base for measuring and evaluating everything. So and try to find exceptions, people who are listening too. And it's just, life capital is the life wealth that produces more life wealth without loss and cumulative gain. I've made that clear. But what that includes isn't just human things. It's all the species. It's all the life support systems of the species. It's all knowledge, real knowledge, that is life, knowledge that enables life and understanding of life. And a technology which serves life as opposed to just, turning out weapons and junk that destroy life. And what's happened in our age, more than ever before, it's very, very unprecedented, is that the life capital, and of course the very earth itself that we are born into and, that we shape as humans, more and more, it's increasingly life capital is under the agency of humanity or society and its social rules, basically, as to whether it is destroyed, degraded, despoiled, as it is being now cumulatively, or whether it recovers and goes further. And the only criterion, the only basis that you can really find, and I've been working on this, for over a quarter of a century, more than that, most of my life, is trying to find this ground. And in the case of economic life ground, it's life capital itself. And so it's the ultimate choice space of humanity and the planet, and you and I both recognize that we are in an unprecedentedly significant choice space that has never happened before, where basically where whether life on Earth continues to degrade and be destroyed, or whether it with all the resources we have of life capital, and knowledge and science and so forth, with all the resources we have and technology we have, we can pull it out. We could change it. We could change it overnight. Once you put it, for example, into trade treaties, for example, which demand everything, but the only thing they protect is foreign, corporate, international, transnational rights to profit. That's the only thing. All these immense trade deals that are never stop. You're going through one. We are with the European Union, and the European Union isn't the social democracy. It's just big money looking for no obstacles to its taking over everything and multiplying its money sequences with no committed life function. That's what it's all about, and that's all that's ever said. They're thousands of pages long, these documents with their appendices. I've actually gone through them, and nothing, no right is protected in any of them except money sequences or opportunities for profit. That's it. That's all. Now, one thing got in, and that's the Montreal Protocol on the ozone layer, where what we have of an ozone layer left is because of that, and they just put it in saying you have to abide by that rule. And that has worked. But nothing is more invisible in the discourses. Nothing is more undiscussed by corporations talking about sustainability is they have to be regulated by life standards on a global basis. There's no other way. Well, what do we mean by life standards? Life standards that protect life capital, without which we die. Any form of life capital is that without which the system suffers and goes under. And then the key is, what exactly is that? And then, we know a lot of it already. We know nutrition levels. We know it, unlike past ages. We know literacy rates. We know how to get them. We know this is just on the human level. We know what diseases are, and we know what the disease ratios are, whether they rise and fall. We know air quality and what's required. We know water purity, noise levels, biodiverse forest cover. We know it all. We have it all, but we haven't pulled it. We haven't joined the dots on any level. We haven't joined the dots in understanding the symptoms. We haven't joined the dots in understanding the cause. And we haven't joined the dots in understanding what we're for. And all of these things are examples of life capital. Life capital really applies to everything. It's the universal term. Physical fitness, we know what physical fitness is, movement of life through range and sustaining power. I mean, you can define everything down to the T. And, of course, we know about public and green spaces being important. We now know what we didn't know before but always suspected, that that makes a difference to people's capacity to work itself, is whether they have green space. We know about what our populations are. We know what housing is required for a life that's, you know, I mean, it's got to have some form of elimination disposal. It's got to have some form of lighting. But, you know, it's a lot less than what we're always talking about. So in short, we know all the things and the habitats and the fish stocks and the employment rates, all the things we need to know, all the coordinates we need to know, we do know, and meaningful jobs for youth, I might add. We know that. We can, but we haven't connected them, there's a great resistance to even defining them. In the literature, and again, I go to my academic life, for 40 years of my academic life, I have not found, it's sort of changed now because of what I have found, there's no criterion of what a need is. They just collapse the distinction between needs and wants, commodities and life goods, in the entire system of economic thinking. It's just collapsed. Even Marx's system, it collapsed. They just see them the same. It's a commodity, it's for a use value that people are willing to pay a price for, and the value is how much they're willing to pay, blah, blah, blah. And we never get down to what's actually needed. And I mean needed for a flourishing life. And that what's always needed is that without which life capacity is reduced or destroyed. Nothing else is needed. But that is needed. And that includes all the good stuff, like reading, like your bicycle or the public transport or, you know, things that you need, that without which life capacity is reduced or destroyed. So we know all this, but somehow you just can't get it in. And this is where ultimately it comes down to, as it were, a demented mind structure that we have here. We have a sick source code. We have a deranged metaprogram. And we can't see it. We can't see its phenomena. We can't join the common cause of it. And we can't find the life ground, the life capital ground, whereby we can measure and judge and move accordingly. Right away, you apply the term life capital to U.S. expenditures, and you're going to find more and more of it, as you've already observed, more and more of it going to what destroys life and less going to what supports life. And but what we need is a hard, rigorous, measurable criterion, and we've got it. So the answer, in short, is underlying us. And perhaps in my whole, because as you know, it's very despairing, when you think of how badly things have gone and cumulatively gone, and not one of these levels have they corrected. There's no feedback loop of correction, but at the height of my despair, I recognized that there was an underlying thing that humans have always had. Excuse me, just taking a drink with all my talking.
Oh, John, indeed. John, I'll just throw in a comment.
The civil comments.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again, and I say it without exaggeration, that because of everything going on today literally is the most perilous time in world history.
Yeah.
And you understand that so well. It's not just raging imperial wars abroad. It's literally waging a war against ordinary people at home. And in so many parts of the world, the Western world, especially across Europe, the Middle East, America, North America, parts of South America. It's really a horrendous system. And unless ordinary people do something to challenge this, it'll only get worse and worse. And literally, we need a social revolution, a nonviolent one. But anything less than that, I guarantee things will be much worse than now, because the powers in Washington and in the capitals of Europe and in Canada, Stephen Harper, that's exactly what these people plan. And only ordinary people can stop it.
Well, you know, it's got to be a combo, really. I mean, revolutionary transformations have often, I remember Marx was, and he was, you know, the mind, so far as he understood it now, things have changed, as I've argued, where he bases himself on productive forces and not life capital, and the banking system, and they had a gold standard and so forth, so he's not. And perhaps it didn't work because he hadn't really worked out the political nature of the system beforehand. But we have, it's really a matter of joining the dots. We haven't joined the dots at the crucial levels. And it, as I say, even Marx, who was, you know, the revolutionary thinker of, well, still is for many people, that he might be, you know, he wants to see, basically, he thinks the independent variable of history, the ultimate determiner, is technological development, and that that's what the revolutions are about. Well, we, you know, it isn't about technological development. It's about saving life on Earth and developing the conditions for its full flourishing, which he thought his system would. So what I was saying was that he was supported by Engels, who was a factory owner, major factory owner in Manchester. So you have to have, and Lenin was, you know, his father was sort of ahead of the whole Russian school system. That, you know, you have to have it at both levels. And it really, the ultimate division is not between left and right or between Marxist and capitalist. The ultimate division really is whether you're, you know, whether it's life grounded or not life grounded, and whether it satisfies the criteria of needs in life capital or not. And that cuts across all populations in a way. First of all, you require, before the revolution, you have to, and I think this is where you're right, there's got to be a popular understanding or a general understanding of what's gone wrong. And that's, of course, what I, you know, and you and I both, but what I try to do it at the do it at a level that will hold through all the changes of the appearances and the events of time. Here's a quote that just comes across here. The Pope recently, and I perhaps shouldn't say this, but my work has been involved, you know, people have been sending my work to the Vatican for a long time. And here's what the Pope recently said, the new one, Francis, the only Francis. It is the consequence of a global choice. He says what we have is a money cult that's gone out of control. I mean, he's catching on. And it's a consequence of a global choice, an economic system which leads to this tragedy, an economic system which has at its center the idol of money. Now, he's taken it quite a lot. That's pretty interesting. That just came out somebody just sent me that a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, it wouldn't, of course, be advertised here. But so you get this. So he gets it. And, of course, he's speaking to millions of people. And I think in Latin America they've gotten it. And, you know, that's a hard, hard ship to turn around. And so the Latin America, you know, what is the form of the revolution is going to take? It can take any, as long as it goes in accordance with life coherent policy and implementation. And where we get it there and where we've gotten it here is that begins, you know, very, very concretely, that begins with your tax system, that you've got to have taxes on incomes and on higher incomes, including the corporates. And the more you have, the more you're taxed. And, the progressive principle, that's an old principle, but it's all been reversed. They brought it back in. And in Ecuador, for example, it's netting more revenues than oil. That's a huge change. Simple. We've known it, but there's just the corporate power has become so totalitarian and absolute that these concepts can't even be raised now without being screamed and yelled at, socialist, you know, whatever, cranky, you know. It's not, you know what it is? It's not left, it's not right, it's deep center. And then, of course, we know that structural poverty is a problem. We've always known that's a problem, and we've found ways to resolve it. They've done quite a bit in Latin America. They've almost eliminated, in several of the countries, they've almost eliminated absolute poverty. And then we know that the key thing is that public ownership and public control of natural resources and of banking, those are the huge ones. If you get public control of the actually publicly owned natural resources, like, for example, the only country that works in Europe basically is Norway, and now again Iceland, they have that, as well as, you know, the higher taxes and so on. And then, that's not going to do you any good unless you get control of the banking system, public control of the banking system. That's well known too. We've had public control of the banking system every crisis that we've met that's been successfully resolved. I mean, that's what China, as I said, has through its revolutionary situation. But it's also what that's also what Norway has, and it hasn't really had a revolution. It's also what Japan had, basically control over public investment, over investment by public means, because it's the basis of money itself. It's that which everything else is leveraged off. It's the only thing that can really run a banking system successfully. Of course, the Americans themselves, the U.S. itself, that's how it got through the Second World War. That's how Canada got through the Second World War and developed into a modern industrial state, was through public control of the banking system. That only got reversed through the BIS, through Wall Street in 1973, which nobody knows. They just said, no, the Bank of Canada or the banks cannot lend to their governments anymore. Well, that's the only thing that works.
We have about 2 minutes left, so I want to alert you so you don't leave out anything important.
Thank you very much, Steve. These things will come back through to us, but it really is. As the civil commons, I guess I haven't mentioned, the civil commons seems like a utopian idea, the universal, any social construct that enables universal access to life goods. And you think, oh, that's a utopian dream. Well, look around. What's the sidewalk out there? What are the light systems that run your power system, if it still works? What is the free schooling system we have? What are the air control without which you have air? Where does that come from? It's all universe, you know, it's all social constructs with enabling universal access to life goods. You try to think of anything you're doing right now, with the water I'm drinking now. How did that happen? That's one of the oldest civil commons things, is water sources themselves, and again, being privatized, corporatized, destroyed, polluted, and so on. But the only way to do it, and the way we always did it, was it was a social construct that has to be ruled, you know, has to have regulations to prevent waste and pollution, and it has to be delivered to every place. That's what got them over all the diseases in London, was where they got a sewage and water system combined. That's a crucial civil commons without which we can't go anywhere. The road, that's, you know, where can you find anything that works that isn't this? Social construct that enables the universal access to some life good or another. So it's all there. That's the history of the human race. That's the evolution of the human race, and it began in language. What is language? It's a social construct that enables universal access to life goods. And what are those life goods? They're words and concepts and ideas and thoughts themselves that have been formed by shared common system. So I hear the music starting, Steve, so I'll say the civil commons has been with us always. It's under attack and a war much greater than the Nazis, and it can be recovered, and in some places is being recovered, and that is our war.
That's the great hope, John. Again, I want to mention your book. It's a very important book, The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, From Crisis to Cure. I absolutely recommend it. I urge listeners to get it, get a copy, read the book. I guarantee you John will teach you a great deal. You can only cover so much in an hour, John, but your book covers it over an extensive number of pages. You go into it in great detail. John, it was another important hour. I look forward to having you back next month.
Thank you, Steve. It was good to be back.
Join us every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, on weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.